Hello, and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 42. This is October 13th, folks. We're in the middle of Halloween times. My name is David Brook, and I'm with Forrest Hollingsworth, the greatest co-host of all time.
On this show, at least. Hello, I am Forrest with two R's, and I think that it is okay to call all of October Halloween.
Yeah, thank you. You know what? I'm trying to start it. And I hope it starts with this show. People are going to listen.
Honestly, you can start in, like, August.
I mean, why not?
As soon as the leaves on the trees are orange, it's Halloween.
If you have candy corn in your pantry, it's Halloween.
If you live near a tree that is orange all the time, it's Halloween. I'm stuck on the tree issue. Let's move on.
All right, moving on. This is a comic book podcast where we recap the latest and greatest news of the week. We talk about...
I'm just saying, yeah. I think the trees tell us when it's Halloween time.
That's true, but what if you live in an area where there aren't leaves changing?
It's not Halloween time.
So it's never Halloween time in Antarctica.
Guess not.
So I guess you're anti-penguin. Is that it?
Actually, it is Halloween time in Antarctica, but only where the thing is happening. That's just Halloween pranks.
Hold on. So your rules have changed. Not only can it be Halloween if the leaves are changing, but if there are monsters present, then it's Halloween.
Yes. The monsters take the leaves off the trees at night.
Oh, wow. This is an interesting myth. So is this like a kid's book you're writing, or?
Most of my brain is a kid's book, yeah.
Actually, I like that idea. Monsters taking leaves off trees, and that's why the leaves change.
Like little gelflings or something.
There you go.
We could workshop this right now. We could say fuck our show notes and just workshop this right now.
Wait, you said gelfling. Have you been watching the Dark Crystal show?
I have been watching the Dark Crystal.
You like it?
I like it a lot. I actually like it more than the movie.
I think it's stronger, personally. The comic, which is by Boom Studios, was pretty good. It's like a prequel to the show.
Mm. I do like the documentary about the making of it, though.
Mm, that was pretty good.
That was fascinating.
I liked it, too, because it confirmed that Simon Pegg is in it, because I didn't believe it. He doesn't sound like his character.
Yeah, yeah. That's the art of acting.
It is the art of acting, which is what we're doing right now, because, you know, we're pretending...
Yeah, I don't even like comics.
Yeah, I don't like... I haven't liked comics for the last 41 episodes. Why start now? But we do recap the news. We talk about comics that came out last week that we liked, and we talk about the week ahead. This week, we're going to devote an entire segment to Hox and Pox, a new disease that's going around America. That's the recent Jonathan Hickman written House of X and Powers of 10 series that wrapped up just this week. And X-Men number 1 comes out next week to start Dawn of X. It's kind of a big thing. If you're part of the X-Men fandom, you will know all about it. If you're not part of the X-Men fandom, you probably aren't listening to the show. So
this is our backdoor into being an X-Men only podcast.
Someone who is an X-Men fan and listening, please go tell the X-Men fan that I just said that. Or non-X-Men fan that I just said that.
Right, yeah.
So to start our show, we always talk about the news. And the top, bitty bit top of the news... DC's rumored 5G plan sounds like it's a go. We talked about this last week a little bit, and I think we were both a little bit sour on this news. Would you say that, Forrest?
I feel that I'm still sour on it, yes.
And that's coming from a guy who doesn't like sour candies, folks. So.
And I was trying to mince words right there. Sour is nice.
I've got this sour candy coming in the Amazon. It's supposedly the most sourest candy ever. I saw the director of Guardians of the Galaxy... What's his name? James Gunn?
Yeah.
He was eating one on Instagram. Go check that out, folks. It's pretty fun to watch him eat a sour candy. Anyway.
Significantly less fun is this DC Comics thing.
Yeah, so...
Go watch James Gunn eat a bad candy instead of do DC Comics.
So Ritesh Babu over at AIPTComics.com wrote this fantastic piece titled...
Yeah, I was just going to say, can I just say about that?
DC Comics rumored 5G initiative will kick off next year. He basically breaks down all the G's in the 5G.
Yep. The piece over on AIPTComics.com that Ritesh wrote is better written than I think this event or whatever it is going to be.
Whoa, those are strong words.
It's a great article, and it made me, like, open to the idea.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, because you know. Ritesh does a good job of basically explaining, you know, rebooting the DC universe is kind of like a trope in itself, right? It's like a reoccurring thing.
Right.
So it's almost like okay for them to do it yet again, even though it's kind of frustrating if you're, you know, a longtime reader and you love these stories, it's constantly changing on you.
I think it's also frustrating and difficult for... So, I'm sorry, we should zoom out a little bit and say DC is rebooting their line in the same way that they did with New 52, 52, Crisis and Hypertime stuff.
Flashpoint.
And there are going to be four different generations happening simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
The first of which is the Heroic Age, and Wonder Woman is opening that up. It's like Silver Age comic storytelling. Or right at the doorstep of the Silver Age comic storytelling, as Ritesh says. It's moving from the late 30s through the late 50s. And then Generation 2 is the Space Age. This starts with Superman. It's the Silver Age of comics all the way to the Bronze Age. Although it seems like it leads all the way up to Crisis on Infinite Earths in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Age 3, or Generation 3, is the Age of Crisis, very obviously, because that was kind of one of the first big shakeups. And in this story that is about shakeups in this manner, like you're saying, it's a trope unto itself. It makes sense to give some credence to that. So the era after Crisis, it spans everything emerging from the 80s to the late 2000s, right up until Flashpoint, another breaking point for DC Comics. And then Generation 4 is the Flashpoint Age. That's going to be everything that we're into now.
Right.
And then Generation 5 is going to be a new age where characters are handing off their heroic mantles, would you say, to other characters, and in ways that are unexpected and maybe exciting if you're a DC fan or reader, in that, like, Batman is handing off the Batman mantle, but not to Damian or even Gordon, rather to Lucius Fox.
Right.
So, hey.
Or Luke Fox. They're trying to tell all of
these simultaneous stories at the same time, and they're trying to make every piece of reboot and retcon and everything fit into one giant continuity.
Right.
The problem is that
it hurts your brain. Paper,
that's interesting, and in reality, it hurts my brain. Yep.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And when it is a lot, and it's not hard to, and it is hard to wrap your head around it, doesn't that hurt the ability for new readers to jump on board, which is the whole point of them doing this?
Exactly.
Like, I understand they're going to give John Kent, Superman's son, more of a focus so that a younger reader who's in their teens to 20, early 20s, can jump in. But as soon as they realize that there's, like, a legion of heroes and there's all this history, like, it's almost too much to take in all at once, right?
Yep. I think so. Especially while they still have Doomsday Clock, which seems to be a kind of reboot, retcon, realignment in the same vein happening at the same time.
Right.
It makes it really difficult for me to understand why I should care about this one more than I cared about any of the other ones before it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole New 52 and all that wasn't even that long ago, right?
No, it was in the decade.
Yeah, so I don't know.
And they did New 52 and 52.
Right, right.
And Flashpoint.
I mean, if you're reading Justice League right now, you can kind of see them. You can see the logic in it, in that the latest issues, there are heroes of the past, the future, and the present all kind of combining. There's all these other, you know, realities of heroes that actually Brainiac has captured. So, like, it's all there to, like, mine new stories, but I don't know. It's just so tiring to have to do it all over again and figure out what's going on.
Right, and I think, you know, the idea of splitting it into generations that literally ape the generations that comics have gone through, or that DC Comics and themselves has gone through, is an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
But putting all those books out at the same time,
yeah,
totally conflates it, makes it huge, makes it unwieldy. People are going to be, if they're trying to make comics approachable, which is ostensibly what this is about, that's what they keep saying.
Yeah.
You can't have a 1950s Wonder Woman comic coming out at the same time as a 2019 Wonder Woman comic, because people are going to be like, how do these things connect?
Right. Do you remember how confusing it was, that Pandora character?
Yeah.
That mysterious character. It's like, I don't know. I feel like, I don't know. They need to get their ducks in a row.
And they're trying, and they're trying, and they're trying. But I don't think that they seem to understand what the issue is.
Right. Meanwhile, over at Marvel, what Jonathan Hickman's done with X-Men, it's like contained it down into a very fine 12 issues that will now sprout into more series, but not like an unwieldy amount. It's not like, it's very centered on this one new direction.
Yeah,
that's easy to follow.
Rob Liefeld disagrees with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it feels much more cohesive.
There are still big questions to be answered, obviously.
Right.
But there's, you can still, you understand where all the main players are, and the ones that matter anyway. Whereas this thing that DC's doing, it's like, huh? What? Huh?
Yeah, I...
It is a little early to be judging it, too, I will admit. We don't know everything yet, but...
It's just that I have such little faith in it, given that it's happened so many times before.
Right, right. Well...
But I changed my mind about Hawks and Pox, too, so... You're totally right.
Oh, that's right. You were against it at first? Or you didn't...
I was a little wary about Jonathan Hickman being a quasi-editor for the line. You know, I feel that those editors' jobs are important.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan... I was worried that he was going to be too close to the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say the same thing with Jeff Johns over at DC, or Dan Didio, or Jim Lee, or Seth. They're all writers and artists. But my mind has been changed by what Hickman has done with the X-Men and the way that he's kind of allowing other creators to pick up this really great foundation he has built.
And all these creators, they're so outspoken on Twitter. It seems like they're having the time of their lives.
Right, exactly.
No one's being forced to write Superboy right now.
Right. I defer to them and I believe them and I hope that they're having a great time. I just don't find, at least until the comics have started, that the foundation for this 5G thing is as strong as that.
Well, if you like X-Men, I highly recommend you check out AIPTComics.com next week. Jonathan Hickman's actually answering your questions, which should be pretty exciting. Hopefully, he's probably not going to give any spoiler answers, but he might enlighten us a little bit on what he's going to do with Dawn of X, which is kicking off next Wednesday with X-Men number one. Our very own Chris Hassan is actually curating a X-Men week and following the house. He asked me to read this to you, by the way. I didn't write this. Following the events of House of X and Powers of Ten, Marvel's mutants have entered an all-new, all-different era. It is the Dawn of X. To celebrate, AIPT brings you X-Men Week, 7 days of original interviews with past and present X creators. And then he wrote this, I don't know what it means. Pax Krakoa, huh?
Long live Krakoa.
Oh, okay, thanks. Is that another language? What's Pax? What does that mean?
Latin.
Ah, oh, fuck. Sorry, guys. I'm a dumb. Anyway, Chris actually interviewed a ton of X creators at New York Comic Con a week or two ago now, and you'll be getting a lot of cool interviews out of that, let me tell you. And that's the end of the news that's actually not news. It's just a promo. In our next bit of news, new Jinx World creator-owned On The Way. Say what, Brian Bendis? You little dirty dog. Him and From now on, even if he comes on the show, we should call him Dirty Dog, by the way.
I have been rendered speechless.
Write that down, secretary. We have a secretary over here. Him and Andre Lima Arujo are going to be doing a collaborating on a creator-owned book in the Jinx world. And, Forrest, you have a strong opinion on this. throw you under the bus.
God, it really sounds like I hate DC every time we pivot to me. Does Brian Michael Bendis need a creator-owned book? Can he be using his platform to give other writers and artists the opportunity to work with DC?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Brian Michael Bendis, Donny Cates, Jonathan Hickman, all of these guys that are, like, leading the new eras of these publishers' lines, they have a safety net.
Right. Years and years of wealth.
I don't want to say that Brian Michael Bendis and... Even Andre don't have an interesting story to tell, and maybe Jinx World is the best avenue for that story. But, man, the same thing I felt with Al Ewing writing every other page of Marvel Comics 1000. Just seed your platform even a little bit for other people to have that opportunity.
Right, yeah.
I think, like,
more voices
I don't know
in the
Brian
field.
Personally. I don't know how well he pitches comics or anything like that. And I don't want to speak ill of the guy. I like quite a bit of Brian Michael Bendis' writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think at some point you must get to the point where you don't realize how great an opportunity you have. That your pitches are just considered totally different than other writers and artists. That your name is marketing. And that I don't know that that DC, and by extension these creators, are appreciative enough that they need to do that. That's what level they've gotten to, and they need to do the same thing for other creators.
Yeah, I don't think there's...
Does that make sense? Does that make me sound like an asshole?
No. You sound bitter. Is that bad?
I saw bitter. Yeah.
A little bitter, but I mean, it makes total sense. I mean, DC doesn't have creator-owned books, very many of them. And
right.
I mean, Bendis has been brought on and basically been given the chance to do whatever the hell he wants, apparently. And that includes...
I mean, yeah, he's got the keys to the house, right?
Yeah. And yeah, and I understand your point. Like, he could use this amazing power for good.
Right. That's what I'm saying. And you said that a lot better than me. Yeah. I would love... I have nothing against this book. I have nothing against the creators.
Mm-hmm.
I just wish that they saw that other people aren't getting the same opportunity and use their power to do something about it.
I am, if we're going to talk about the book a little, not that there's any detail about it, but first of all, Arujo is amazing. That'll be
Yes.
I mean,
I'm really excited. Yeah.
And another, just one little point I want to make about Jinx World. It seems like a lot of their books, like Cover, for instance, their intention is to do something different with the comic book format. Either the way it mixes story and art or whatever. Like Cover in particular, that's the one I mostly read and reviewed. There was things done in that I just have never seen before, which makes me go, huh, okay. But at the same time, I'm not like dying to read Jinx World books. It's just that creative element. It's probably for someone who's brand new to comics or someone who's really bored of comics and wants something new.
Superhero comics.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I totally see your point. It'd be interesting to see, you know, maybe it's because Jinx World's not super popular that there's only like a handful of books. But if it does become popular, if he were to give the keys to others to kind of go crazy. But at the same time, it's like, it's almost like a Stephen King line or something, right? Like he owns it. He's not giving away the writing credits to anyone.
Right.
So I don't know. Is there anything else like that in comics, Jinx World? I guess Neil Gaiman, maybe.
I mean, I think Vertigo used to be that way.
Wait a minute. Right over...
Well, no, it didn't.
DC Vertigo, Gaiman gave the keys of Sandman to, like... And the Sandman universe to, like, four different creators.
Yeah, that's a great model. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. See?
Or even what we were just saying about Jonathan Hickman giving the Dawn of X books to writers and artists outside of himself.
Right, he could have been, like, a jerk about it and been like, no, I'm doing X-Men and that's
it. Yeah, it's only going to be X-Men and I'm writing it.
Right. Well, okay, this is actually some more negative news for DC, I'm sorry. But in our next bit of news, Batman The Last Knight on Earth, number 3, has been pushed back 5 weeks. That's a long time, folks. Now, I'm a little surprised by this because when Scott Snyder was on the show... God, when was this? April? Months ago.
Yeah, a couple months ago.
He said that...
And the show's been downhill since.
He said that issue number 3 was, like, almost done. And that, like, he was getting pages back for 2 and whatnot. So I'm, like, I'm a little surprised. I don't know why there'd be a 5-week delay unless it's supposed to align with something else happening at DC.
It could just be that the book has been subject to a lot of changes since then, too.
That's true.
I know you, Snyder himself, or you mentioned to me that he tends to write pages and then get the art and then rewrite.
Yeah.
So it definitely could have happened that way. And the reasoning behind this is that Capullo was working on Spawn, right?
Yeah. Snyder actually tweeted that, first of all, this book's extra large. It's 54 pages instead of 48. But also, he helped with Spawn number 300, too.
Oh.
Snyder.
Okay.
Yeah, he has a story credit, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Didn't we talk about that on the show? Maybe you weren't here for that. I forget.
I'm not sure. I know we talked about, and I haven't forgotten that we're going to see how Spawn 301 does, and one of us is going to draw Spawn for the other and mail it to them.
Is it okay if I just, if I take pictures of myself as Spawn? Would that work? Okay, cool.
Absolutely.
That's an upcoming bet. I can't wait for that.
That's maybe better.
I don't know. What do you think? You haven't been reading this, right? I don't think you have.
I have been reading.
Oh, you have? Okay.
I read the first 2 issues.
Sorry.
The scope of that book is so big.
I know. It's like it shouldn't be just 3 issues, should it?
Yeah, no. It shouldn't be.
It should be a line of comics. Dawn of Batman. And why aren't you giving other creators a chance to tell stories, Snyder?
The scope of that book is so big that I can see it being subject to a lot of changes.
Yeah.
Even when they had a strong original draft or script.
But at the same time, though, it's DC Black Label. It's its own thing. It doesn't have to... It's not continuity bound.
That's true. That's true. I don't know. I don't feel the same way that I feel about this as I do about Doomsday Clock or whatever.
Yeah.
Because I know that this third issue is a finite end where Doomsday Clock has just been unwieldy and changing. And I think they're probably writing the 12th issue right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel the same way about this. I have a lot of faith in Snyder and Capullo, and I also don't want artists or writers to overwork themselves, so I think it's totally appropriate.
I definitely love the format better than Doomsday Clock. Could you imagine if Jeff Johns and Gary Frank did 3 60-page issues instead of 12 20-pagers right. that took right. 4 million years to put out?
Yeah, and you wouldn't feel that strongly about the problems that Doomsday Clock had if you're like, well, it's just one more issue that needs to come out.
Right.
Versus like, oh God, we're on the 6th issue.
Right.
Of 12.
Right. It's a different format too. I mean, it definitely changes the way you read and tell a story if you have that many more pages.
You know what? If a novels come out in trilogies all the time.
Speaking of novels, Marvel launches its second prose book line deal. Yeehaw, those who like to read just words without pictures, you lazy bums. Wait, no, I'm the lazy bum. They are working with Asmodee Entertainment. What?
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Yeah, that's weird.
Anyway, this is from a press release on Newsarama.com. So they already have a deal with Scholastic, or Simon and Schuster, I mean. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and real quick, I want to zoom out and say, the reason that that's weird to me is because Asmodee makes board games.
Right. It sounds like Asmodee is becoming like a big conglomerate.
A publisher. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're growing.
I wonder if they bought up some novel shops or something.
This is the first something that they haven't created whole cloth. Mm. Like the work that they're okay. working with. It's like the first partnership.
The licensing thing.
Yep. Yeah. But they did say, you can look out for Legends from Asgard, several volumes focusing on some of Marvel's heroines, and stories of some of Professor Xavier's lesser-known students. And that's just to get us started. So that's kind of interesting. They're not telling necessarily like a boring, another Spider-Man story. They're actually focusing on characters.
I was just going to say.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I'll read it when they get to Spider-Man.
Oh, I see. No, you know, you see all the time fans going, why aren't there more? Why is like Magneto or Doctor Doom getting a story? Shouldn't Jean Grey get her own story or Husk or whatever? So maybe this is a chance for those lesser known characters to finally get the focus they deserve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope one's about Beak.
There you go. Is he still around?
I haven't seen him.
Yeah, hopefully.
He's got to be on Krakoa.
I mean, Xavier, I mean, maybe he didn't, you know, clone
Beak
him yet.
Beak rights now. Beak rights now. Beak takes the leaves off trees.
Maybe. I mean, have to climb, though. He can't fly.
Circling back to Jesus, I feel like I'm all over the place. I'm sorry.
We're circling back to Jesus now.
Yeah, circling back to this. They're doing that, like, podcast book storytelling with Serial Box. They're still working on that. They're obviously publishing plays and stuff.
Yeah.
This feels like the most experimental that Marvel has been in a really long time, and that excites me.
Yeah, that they can tell stories outside of just single-issue comics.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that I like that DC's doing right now is those YA books.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels experimental and exciting and new to me, and they feel like a totally different type of content and format than their weekly books.
Yeah.
And I think Marvel has seen the success of that and trying to find what works for them without just straight up and down emulating exactly what DC's doing. And I like that kind of competitiveness.
Yeah, it's definitely capturing a different audience.
I do wish it was about Spider-Man, though.
Yeah, there's no hint there about Spidey getting in those stories. No. Sorry.
I'll write it.
Okay.
I'll write it.
All right. Start now.
I felt the same way about, we didn't talk about this on the show, but Marvel is going to be publishing some Warhammer 40K books. They partnered up with Games Workshop for that.
Yeah.
And I also feel like, CB, get in touch. I can write the shit out of an Adeptus book or Mechanicus book.
At the 25 or so minute mark, tell CB to listen. Tag him on Twitter. Maybe he'll hear you.
I'll write a Necron book, too.
There you go.
Yeah.
Not a Necron book.
I could write the shit out of that. But Kieran Gillen started tweeting, and I was like, oh, never mind. Kieran Gillen's going to write a 40K book for Marvel.
Oh, really? Oh, that's cool.
Well, not officially. But as soon as it was announced, he posted the news about it from Newsarama or something like minutes after the article went up,
mm-hmm.
and basically pitched an entire story in the replies to that tweet.
This reminds me of when he was saying he wanted to do a Sinister story, and I don't think anything's happening with that.
We'll see.
We'll see.
There's a lot of room in X-Men for that.
That's true.
And I think that's the best part of his X-Books. Anyway.
Maybe they can get Marcelo Ferreira to draw it. Now that he has signed an exclusive Marvel deal.
So good.
In our next bit of news, Marcelo has just signed an exclusive deal. They never say how long these deals are. But he has been working with Marvel.
I'm happy for them.
Yes, of course. I mean,
but what if it's like 2 books?
Yeah. I mean, I think generally speaking, they're going to keep him busy. And I hope he makes a little more money if he signs exclusively. He has to, yep. Right?
I think so. I think they probably get an advance.
He's going to be drawing the Morbius book coming out in the next couple weeks.
Vita Ayala's Morbius, yeah.
Yeah. And he's done some great work. He did the Punisher War of the Realms tie-in.
Yep. He did some fantastic work on Spider-Man books.
Uh-huh. Very dark.
Spider-Man. But I was very surprised that this exclusivity came through. And I'm very happy for Marcelo, and congratulations. I wish that more publishers guaranteed opportunities to writers and artists like this.
Sure.
Because that's what I was saying. It's like the problem is that a select few have a safety net, right?
Right.
But congratulations to Marcelo. And I'm really excited to see what he does and what he's working on.
After Morbius.
After Morbius, yeah.
Or during Morbius.
Well, whatever form it takes.
You know,
I'm surprised by how few books he's written for Marvel before they snatched him up.
Or drawn, you mean?
Yeah,
yeah.
Drawn. And the same thing with Donny Cates. He hadn't written very many Marvel things before they were like exclusive. So maybe it's the strength of a pitch, or maybe it's the strength of his personality, something like that, that Marvel really likes. And I think that's great, because comics in particular, you have to have a very strong personal brand that extends between the work of comics, writing and drawing a comic. You also have to be good at networking with other creators, publishers, and customers. You have to have a strong brand on social media,
mm-hmm.
all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very, very difficult, and to see a publisher put faith into an artist like this is exciting, and I think it probably feels really good for them.
Oh, gotta be.
Yeah.
They like me. They really like me.
Right, exactly. I think that's great.
You know, we really like comics over here at AIPTComics.com, and we have a segment. Don't tell anybody, this is a secret, but it's called Top Books of Last Week. Where we pick our favorite books. And we don't want anyone to know, not even the creators. Don't tell them. Don't tell them. If they find out, they'll, you know, want to listen.
We definitely will not be tagging them in the tweet that we send out about this issue.
I definitely don't do that every week and annoy people, I'm sure. So in this segment, we talk about our two favorite books that came out last week. And we always start this segment by talking about Comic Book Roundup and the number one critic and the number one fan pick. The number one critic pick was These Savage Shores, number 5, with a 9.5. Our very own Ritesh Babu gave it a 10 out of 10.
I chose it as one of the best covers of last week.
You did.
By the cover.
You did. I saw that. Nice work, buddy. And the number one fan pick was Coffin Bound, number 3, which is a book Ritesh is going to write a review for. I don't think he's written it yet, but he will, and he probably will love it as well. It got a 9.8.
Congrats to both these books, and congrats to their publishers, because they're both indie books.
You know, it's funny. Indie books seem to come up here a lot, and yet our top two picks are always Marvel and
DC. I was just going to say, my picks are corporate as fuck.
I always feel bad about that, but I don't know. It's just sometimes the indie books don't strike my fancy like these other books.
You know what?
Hmm?
I will admit to you right now.
Do it. Admit it. Don't do it. Don't tell them.
I'm getting mixed messages. I like indie books more than corporate comics in general.
Here comes a but.
But I don't like it. I like reading indie books all at once.
Mm-hmm.
In a trade or something like that.
Sure.
Whereas corporate comics, and that's what I'm calling DC and Marvel and maybe Dark Horse, they feel soap opera-y. It's fun to buy into the week-to-week
storytelling. That's true.
I would rather read the complete collection of Little Bird, These Savage Shores, Coffin Bound, etc., etc. And I understand the importance of buying single issues to support both your local comic book store and these publishers and these writers and artists. And sometimes I just buy the individual issues based off the strength of the reviews for the first issue or whatever, and then read them all when it's done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I'm a trade waiter, because I'm not. But I think that's a totally valid thing to do, and I hope that these publishers understand that.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that sales as far as graphic novels are probably bringing in more cash than the single issues anyway.
Yeah, I think that in general they are. That's what our kind of monthly reviews would indicate.
Mm-hmm. So, can I tell you about my second favorite book of the week?
You can tell me.
It was a little book called Gwenpool Strikes Back with an exclamation point, number 3. They didn't write that part out. I just had to say that.
Although that is a great miniseries name.
It is, it is. Leah Williams and David Baldion did this one, and it is insane. This issue is, I saw actually, I don't know how many reviews came out, but on Wednesday morning, I was checking the scores to see how my 9.5s fared against others, and there was like a 2. And their review...
Divisive.
Yes. Their review was like, it's too chaotic. It makes no sense. And my review was, you need to buckle in for Gwenpool because this is a ride with some awesome whiplash. Like, I literally said the same thing, but I said I loved the fact that it was insane. It's just so chaotic. Gwenpool basically realizes she needs to be a villain in order to get better sales so she doesn't get canceled. And she ends up creating this like island where all the heroes show up and they have to fight each other. And I don't know, there's just, Williams is doing such a great job kind of lampooning comics in general or specific characters in general. And it's just, and Baldion is doing a fantastic job as well with the art. The comedic timing is just spot on. I was laughing while reading this, and I think it might be the funniest book on the stands right now. Even though this is Halloween month. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that I saw a lot about Gwenpool on Twitter.
Oh, yeah?
And I saw a lot of screen caps and a lot of people telling me that it's like the funniest, nicest book that they've read in a while. And that makes me really happy because Gwenpool is a character that has a kind of a tumultuous background.
Oh, yeah?
People can get it way wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that Leah has such a sharp, refined voice for it.
I've never seen a comic directly reference the cover in the book, which is interesting.
She I saw that one a lot where she says, give me a D cup.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then he did.
Yep. And she's like posing for the cover as if the artist was standing right there.
Yeah. I love that the cover is like the exact same thing, but like it has better lighting and shit.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like it was like photoshopped after the fact, you know?
Yeah, Terry Dodson's done a good job with these.
I feel like that is very intentional. I bet Terry and Leah talked about that.
Which you don't usually see because actually largely these covers, the creators are given like a sentence and they have to riff off that. And they're also created months in advance to get to the solicits in time.
That's why Todd Knock is so good at what he does.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite, second favorite book of the week?
My second favorite book of next week, last week?
Last week.
Is it future or is it past?
Depends on what era. Is it the heroic era? Is it atomic era?
My favorite book of last week was Powers of 10, number 6, written by Jonathan Hickman with art by R.B. Silva. When House of X ended the previous week, House of X number 6, it was really fantastic and it felt like this nice warm ending that the X-Men haven't gotten in a really long time. And it made me feel like I needed to prepare mentally for Jonathan Hickman tearing that all away from us in Powers of 10, number 6, because there has to be some sort of inherent drama or villain or, you know, something comic booky, soap opera-y.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like they were going to give us a happy ending with House of X and then a sad ending with Powers of 10. And the boldest thing that they could possibly do, which they did with Powers of 10, number 6 here, is not do that at all.
Right.
This just compounds exponentially on top of that happiness and that strength and that warmness. And it doesn't feel like a step backward for the X-Men. It feels like a really strong step forward into the Dawn of X books. I think that they did a great job answering a lot of fans' questions about Moira and Magneto and Xavier and all that stuff. But I also feel like they did a really great job of establishing a mission statement for the Dawn of X books. in a way that I don't see very often.
Mm-hmm.
Or a trust, or establishing a trust in the creators to come after these books that I don't see very often. And that by giving us a completely happy story, especially for the X-Men of all people,
mm-hmm.
they defied readers' expectations and conventions.
Right.
I think that that's incredibly brave storytelling, and I liked it a lot, a lot, a lot. Not as much as my number one pick, which surprised me, but I thought it was really fantastic.
We'll talk a little bit more about this, too, in our yes. segment.
And I am talking around it a little bit because I don't want to spoil what happens in this issue.
Can you spoil your number one pick? Spoil the whole thing.
Yeah, sure. I'll just read the issue page by page.
Oh, can I do the pictures? I'll do the pictures while you read the words. Okay,
tell me about your number one pick.
Oh, I gotta go? I thought you were gonna go.
Go for it. You're going for
man.
It.
Okay, Joker Harley, Criminal Sanity number one by Cammy Garcia with art by Michael Mayhew and Miko Swan. I always get his name wrong, I think. Anywho, Cammy was on the show, gosh, a month ago now to talk about this. Finally came out, and it's a fabulous issue. I got to read it early, so I kind of already had a heads up on this, but I reread it, and I love how Mayhew and Miko, their art kind of flip-flops from, because one is telling the story now, one is telling flashbacks. The story is very dark. It's perfect for that Halloween time of year. Just look outside and see if there's a tree with some leaves that are falling, so you'll know. I think Garcia, one of the strengths of her writing is not only making Harley like a very endearing and interesting and respectable character that is stronger than I think she's ever been written. Whoa, that's a statement. But also the homework has been done as far as serial killers, psychology. It feels very real. It feels like it could be easily turned into a TV show and you would believe all these characters and how they talk and what they uncover and what's going on. I can't wait for the series to be over so I could read it all in one sitting because
yeah.
I'm kind of dying for the next one. Joker, I don't think appears in this issue, but I was told by someone in my comments on my review at aptcomics.com that in fact he does. And I actually went back and I think he does appear in the issue, but not like directly.
Not in the way you would expect.
Right. And that was one of my negatives in my review. Like Joker, you don't really get to see Joker or get the perspective of Joker. And
which, I mean, open to a slow burn, of course, but not maybe for the titular character.
I mean, he's in the title, folks. So I was expecting a little more of that. That's the only thing that I think could have strengthened it a little bit, the narrative, because I do think this is more of a cat and mouse story. At least that's how she came off when, in the interview that we did. I'm not sure I understand. Oh, God, Siri, shut up. But, when you read this first issue, it feels like it's a Harley Quinn book. Now, we'll see if it is, because it could still just be a Harley Quinn book. But from what she said in the interview, I mean, she talks about how we see flashbacks with Joker and when he was a child. So to sort of explain how this this genius killer came to be. But anyway, this is a fantastic first issue. I think it's perfectly timed for October. It's scary. It's creepy. If you like procedural crime dramas, give this one a look. And the art is so hyper-realistic, it's practically a TV show in itself. You wouldn't have happened to have picked a book that was in the same sort of vein, would you?
I was just going to say the reason that I like my book so much is because it is procedural crime drama.
Oh.
Unlike the other book with this character that's coming out right now.
Uh-huh.
This book is called The Batman's Grave, number one. It's written by Warren Ellis, and it has art by Brian Hitch. I liked it because of the insight into Batman's psyche that Warren Ellis is kind of using as a mission statement for this limited series.
Yeah.
And then also the way that Brian Hitch backs that up with art. There's a really fantastic conversation in the middle of this book where Batman is talking about trying to save people one by one. And Alfred is countering, you know, it would be easier for you to just save the entire city. You have to think like a criminal. You have to make your plans big, right? And Batman turns to him and says, I can't think like a criminal. I can only think like a victim. Right before he steps into this room that is dedicated to emulating crime scenes, basically. So he it's like the holodeck. He perfectly rebuilds this crime scene, and he's reviewing it and emulating what it would feel like to be the victim. It even projects him in the victim's clothes after this grisly murder. He's piecing everything together, and this guy, the victim, has pictures of Batman pinned up all over the walls. The two-page splashes in this from Hitch are fantastic. They're so detailed. They're so lifelike and well-rendered, and gritty in the way that the story is, too. And he's imagining himself as this person. And just after saying, "I can only think of myself as the victim," when he's emulating this person, he says, "The Batman is a criminal." And that kind of insight and that incisiveness to understand the psyche that propels Batman alongside his villains like Joker, Bane, all these other people that I think of themselves as villain.
Mm-hmm.
Or as victim,
mm-hmm.
don't understand that they are being perceived as villains or criminals, right? And you can see a very easy, obvious parallel, this connection, this really, really fantastic, beautiful scene between what Batman is saying he is and what he actually is. And that's what I've always liked about Warren Ellis's take on the character.
Ellis can do no wrong in my mind.
Yeah, that Castlevania show also kicks ass. But I thought, you know, I got a very good sense of where they're going with this story from that. And it ends right after with a really creepy cliffhanger. But that one individual segment sold me on the entire book, both in terms of narrative, storytelling, subtext, and then also the artistic execution.
Nice. How long is the series again? I forget.
I think it's 6 issues.
6 issues. Nice. And obviously it's like an Elseworlds tale. It's not necessarily happening in continuity right now.
I mean, yes. I don't think that there's a conceit to this book that it is set in the far future, like Last Night on Earth, or that it is a steampunk or anything like that. This is probably just a story that happens sometime in Batman's life, just not in King's right now.
Nice. Yeah, I will mirror what you said. The art is amazing in that book.
Yeah, man. There's a 2-page splash of the Batcave that I was like, it really tapped into that like childhood admiration for that shit.
That's got to be like the number one dream of any comic artist who works in the superhero medium, to draw the Batcave.
Probably. I think it's up there, dude. Yeah.
I mean, Jim Lee's done it like 17 times and he still wants to do it. All right. Well, those were our two favorite books of last week. Go out and get them. We highly recommend them. In our next segment, spoilers, we're going to be talking about Powers of 10 and Hawks. House of X. The 12-issue series, which is actually going to be in hardcover format in December if you haven't read it yet.
I picked up the individual issues. I'm going to keep them bagged, and I'm going to buy that hardcover.
Did you get any variant covers?
I did.
Nice. So it's over. It's all done. I think that we both agree it was a wild success.
In terms of just how much I enjoyed it, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. But then also in general, yes. I mean, this book is doing numbers. And also I've seen people that haven't read it, by their own admission, haven't read the X-Men in like 10 years.
Yeah.
Super excited about this. Just as much as people that have never read the X-Men excited about it.
Right. I'm very curious to see what Hickman says tomorrow in X-Men Monday, but I actually went back to our notes for episode 22 of this show. We actually talked about some of Hickman's answers. He actually answered a few questions for X-Men Monday.
Right, he did opt into one of the X-Men Mondays, right.
And the two questions that we talked about was, who is going to make up your core X-Men team going forward? And he said, Hox and Pox aren't really structured that way. They're not really stories about teams or missions. Saying that, they have teams and missions, but it's not the point. Going forward, however, I think the idea of teams and schools and other ways to get things done aren't necessarily the kind of things that we want to hold too tight to. I don't want to give the game away, so I'm not going to say any more, but we won't be doing gold and blue teams in the traditional manner. So, yep. Obviously, since then, with the Dawn of X reveal, we understand now there are many different books, but they're not your traditional blue yellow teams. They're
right. Yeah, they're not Power Rangers teams as much as they are different segments of a society.
Right, like we got the pirate book, we've got the sort of the killer book where they're going on secret missions, et cetera, et cetera.
X-Men CIA.
Right.
Yeah.
Every book that's coming out in the next couple weeks has an identity of its own. And it all sprouts from House of X and Powers of Ten's sort of... What would you call it?
Yeah, I think thesis? The strength of the books isn't reliant just on who makes up those teams. Like other previous books may have been Red, Gold, and Blue, you know?
What would you say was the top two things that worked in House of X and Powers of Ten? And then I'll say my two.
Okay.
I'm totally throwing you on under the bus.
Go for it. Yeah, because you didn't let me prep for this at all.
I didn't.
I have three things, actually.
Ooh, my God.
The first is Mr. Sinister.
Mm-hmm.
I love this flamboyant, sassy, dramatic character. I love also that his wantonness and his silliness betrays the fact that he is sinister.
Right. Yeah, he's sick. He's kind of sick, right? He likes to mess with people.
You know, he's a better clown prince of crime than that other guy.
Yeah.
I like that a lot, this dichotomy between a character that is like, he seems so earnest and authentic and stuff when people are speaking to him, but that's a character he's playing.
Right, right.
The second is that I think that they did a fantastic, amazing job of saying that every X-Men story before this is canon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It made me dislike Flashpoint, New 52, and all that stuff all the more.
It's like the correct way to do a retcon.
It's the correct way to do it, yep. And the third is that I really loved that it was revealed that the X-Men take the leaves off the trees and make Halloween.
Did you plan on saying that when you said three?
Yeah.
You son of a bitch. For me, the two top things that worked, Moira, obviously, huge. I mean, it kind of goes along with your second point there, but giving this character so much more importance, but her mutant power is what fascinates me. It opens up, in my mind, what mutant powers can be in that, you know, usually it's like, oh, this guy shoots fireballs and this person, you know, has a healing factor or whatever. But this is like game changing. Like it literally can change reality, the powers that these mutants have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw someone on Twitter. I can't remember their name for the life of me, and I'm very sorry. Saying that they're really looking forward to the eventual scene where Moira puts a gun to her head and threatens to end the timeline.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is her power to, like, be reborn and change everything kind of changes the game. And what other powers could there be for mutants? Could there be a mutant with a different kind of power that, I don't know, brings back Jesus? I don't know. God, David, why did you say that?
Weird. I do love how metafictionally it also mirrors... It's literally a mutant power about comics.
Right, right. Yeah, and you could do that with Gwenpool or something. Like, you could have a mutant power that breaks the fourth wall, for all we know. My second thing that I think it did really well is in the very last issue that came out this week, we learned that there is another enemy, right? It's not robots. It's not humans. It's something else.
Right, yep.
And, you know, since the beginning of X-Men, it's always been about, you know, humans versus mutants in some way, shape, or form.
The minority mutant metaphor, basically, yeah.
And it sounds to me like Hickman is bringing it to a whole nother level. And I think it makes sense for this day and age because, you know, with global warming and mass populations and, you know, people starving and people not having enough water, we need to band together as one. And it sounds to me like there's another threat that we're not yet completely clear on that would bind all of humanity and mutants together against a cause. And that just makes so much sense to me, even though I know like that trope of the psychotic human that makes a robot to kill a mutant is been redone so many times and people love it. It makes me think that we're still moving in a new direction, even though these two books have already reset things and got us moving in a new direction. There's even more to come.
Sure. Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. I really love, by extension, what you're talking about, and I think it's good to talk around that reveal because that is kind of the conceit of the whole thing.
Yeah.
That I really love the way that Hickman has made the X-Men a sci-fi story.
Right, right. Which makes so much sense given their powers and everything.
Right, yeah. I love how much it is about science. I love how many weird, obscure, and also big references there are to different schools of science and physics and astronomy and all that stuff. And I also love how religious he has made the X-Men. There are a lot of scenes depicting Eden or Jerusalem or Israel or, you know, and also the kind of, it's emulating in a very interesting way the persecution of religious groups and minorities and stuff throughout the world. And there, I think all minorities or oppressed peoples want to find faith in something beyond themselves and to also build a society around that and to feel safe in feeling that and wanting that.
Yeah, there's like this base desire.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that with the character at the end.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And I will say, you know, I have no... I am pro-Krakoa. I'm pro the society, especially as a queer person who sometimes... no offense to these people, but sometimes I don't want to be around straight people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just want to be in a space where everyone understands me and my experience and the nuance of my experience and how their experiences are different, and it's full of love and compassion and understanding, without having to explicitly explain our humanity or our right to exist to people.
Mm-hmm.
And Krakoa is so, this new version of Krakoa is so strong to me because of that. And then to draw these parallels between real life science and real life religion and real life experience and humanity and society and stuff, it makes it all the stronger, and it makes it so obvious that it is about something. It's about something, not we all hate the Magnet Man.
Magnet Man. That's funny. Okay, so now, hot take, what didn't work for you with Hox and Pox?
I initially liked them, but then I, by the end of the 12 issues, the infographics were a little much for me.
They weren't adding anything, or they felt...
Yeah, it didn't feel... Yeah. I felt like, except for, with the exception of Powers of 10 number 6, the one that came out last week, that... each one was weaker than the last.
There definitely were a couple where it was like, oh, they're just doing this because they need to do it every week now.
Yep, yep. And I like, you know, I like that kind of world building, but also some of it really overstepped the boundaries into showing, telling, not showing.
I wonder if they're going to continue these at all in X-Men or any of the other books. Probably not.
I doubt it very much. Yeah. Although they may take place in the books that Hickman is writing, New Mutants, First Arc, and X-Men, but because he likes that a lot, but I don't think he's by any extension going to force other writers to do it.
I wanted to say, well, the one thing that didn't work for me entirely was the super duper far in the future alien stuff.
And that only clicks in this last issue, right?
Right. Like... Yeah. I think a lot of the times it was being obtuse to be obtuse. It was trying to be, you know, mysterious and interesting because it was mysterious and interesting when it didn't necessarily have to be. And right now it's still very much a big question mark on like the identity of these things. And
yeah, and I really, to piggyback off of that, I don't feel that the Fowling story was essential.
Right. Yeah.
Yet.
I mean, yeah.
Yet.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, that's probably what we're going towards, some massive battle between them and the mutants and or whatever. I don't know. Although he has done a very good job, Hickman's done a very good job, along with R.B. Silva and Pepe Larraz, to create a lot of potential infighting with the mutants. as we learned in the last House of X, there's these boards of the government that are, they're manned by some of the worst villains in X-Men history.
Yeah.
I'm sure that, and then in the very last issue, last two issues of these, House of X and Powers of 10, we see Apocalypse like smug with his arms crossed in the shadows, like angry. Like, you know, he's just plotting to do something terrible.
Interesting. That's what you got out of that?
I did.
I got that he was lonely.
Oh, I guess so. That could work.
Because
I know
he's a hero. In Excalibur.
Yeah, right. But then he looks mad to me. Is it because that he's been a bad guy for so long that he has no friends?
I think so. Yeah, he's only had the Horsemen.
Well, I mean, we know that some of these villains are going to turn. It may not be Apocalypse. I could be wrong there for sure. But you know what I mean? Like, there's definitely going to be some battling. I mean, the way Magneto and Xavier have basically told everyone these are the rules, and then they kind of viciously send Sabretooth into a hole to live a terrible existence for the rest of time. I can only imagine that there's going to be some troubles ahead for mutants. Do you agree?
You said that so well that I kind of was like derailed my train of thought. Yeah, I think it's a very hopeful, idealistic story to me that has an undercurrent of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that.
So what of the Dawn of X books, which one are you looking forward to the most because of House of X and Powers of Ten and what they've set up?
New Mutants.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
I love the idea of the X-Men being in space. I love the idea of continuing this very strong sci-fi element that was introduced or kind of revisited in Pox and Hox. And I just love that cast of characters so, so much. I wish that I were able to be really excited about Fallen Angels,
mm-hmm.
because X-23 is probably my, aside from Spider-Man or Venom, my most favorite comics character of all time. But God, I hate Kid Cable.
Right.
New Mutants.
Nice. I'm looking forward to X-Men in that I know at the, I don't know if it was at New York Comic Con or San Diego, I forget now, but Hickman was saying, you know, this team is constantly going to be changing. It's not just like one core, like X-Men Blue. And that excites me because as a team, that means it's very fluid. It means it's going to be constantly changing. I don't know why, but that's part of the reason why I want to read this book. I know that Hickman's writing it and Wu's drawing the first arc at least. So I'm curious to see what the identity is, because obviously it's the big team book, the biggest probably of all these books, because it's X-Men. But like, how does that shift? How does the lineup change constantly? Like, why? Why is this happening? Is it because they go on different missions every story arc, or what?
Is it a multi-generational story better told than 5G?
Who knows? We'll find out in the next 2 months. But yeah, you know, to your point, though, one of the reasons why I'm not as interested in New Mutants is because I'm not super interested in the space aspect. But that's that's part of the joy and beauty of this entire line of Dawn of X, because each book seems to have its own identity and a strong one.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We don't have like five X-Men books and they're all kind of telling the same story in one. I mean, I'm sure there'll be crossover events. There will be, for sure. But each book has a different identity, and they've definitely put a lot of time and energy into making it feel different from each other. It's not just X-Men Yellow, X-Men Blue.
Right. Yeah. It's not based on the strength of you like Rogue and Gambit, so read this book.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm really excited for Dawn of X. I've never been this excited for X-Men. Actually, you know, I was very excited for X-Men when Bendis took over and brought back the young X-Men, just because I thought that was an insane idea.
My favorite X-Men story of all time, or run, is Grant Morrison's run.
Oh, that was fabulous, yeah.
New X-Men, I think, is the most excited about X-Men I've ever been, the most I've ever engaged with the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And this setup for Dawn of X seems like it continues that, or at least there's some through lines. So I would echo that this is the most excited I've ever been for a generation of the X-Men.
Nice.
Yeah, it means we're going to be all the harder on it when it's not good.
Something's going to have to. But, it can't all be perfect.
But for the time being, I'm really excited. And I really like these kinds of overviews for different arcs and stuff that we have done with Powers of Ten and House of X. And I hope that there is a book in Dawn of X that makes us want to do the same thing.
Mm.
I think that we'll probably continue this segment, just so folks know, whether it's X-Men or not. But I'm hopeful that it will be X-Men.
Based on the sales, you have to think DC, Marvel, they're probably going to pull another one of these where they cancel or close up shop on all the books.
Yep.
Say Spider-Man, and then have Spider-Man be told in two different books over 12 weeks, and then new and bold and something that's still in continuity, but new and bold and doing something different.
Yeah. And it's I hope that it is based on the strength of creators and artists that are interested in telling a shared story.
Yeah, right. Character story and bigger story too. It's not just some cash grab that because we're bringing Rob Liefeld back for Avengers Reborn or whatever Jesus that was. Christ. Do you remember that in the 90s? Like, so often it feels like these comic publishers, they know they'll make money if they get some hot artist to draw the first three issues.
Yep.
But they didn't put any thought into, like...
There's no consistency, yeah.
The big story. And that's where people stick around and keep reading.
And to circle back around to Liefeld, in case people think that we missed it this week, I am aware that he is talking about suing Marvel.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I very explicitly do not want to talk about it on this fucking show.
And he had comments about House of X and Powers of 10. You referenced that a second ago, but we won't talk about that. In our next segment, top books for next week, we talk about the number one book we're looking forward to out next week. What is your number one book you're looking forward to, Forrest?
The number one book I'm looking forward to is Gene Luen Yang's Superman Smashes the Klan.
Ooh, that sounds controversial, but it shouldn't be.
I was going to say, it's not controversial to me, bud.
Could you believe the world we live in now?
I no. I don't have a lot to say about it.
It looks great. It looks cool. I like how bold it feels.
Of Superman being used to tell a story that is hard line, moralistic, and ethical.
Right.
In a way that Superman doesn't often get to be, because he... For whatever... Over time, Superman has become a kind of vanilla, neutral character. And I detest that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it's the image that the original creators had for Superman to Jewish men.
Right.
And I love the idea of returning to this aspect of Superman's identity.
Yeah.
And fuck the Klan.
Yeah, seriously. It seems like a statement that should be an easy one for everyone, but it isn't anymore.
Yeah.
My most anticipated book out next week is X-Men number 1 by Jonathan Hickman with art by Lionel Francis Wu. I don't know if you've heard about this book or listened to the last 20 minutes of the show. I'm very excited to see this first thrust into Dawn of X, to see how this chain is. It feels different than House of X and Powers of 10. House of X to Powers of 10, very, very self-contained story, a very methodical and obviously well thought out chapter page by page, whereas now we're getting back into a serial storytelling with X-Men number 1. What does that book look like? And it's going to be interesting because it's not going to be as thought-provoking, I assume, as these last series. It's going to be more of like fun superhero stuff while continuing that same story. So yeah, I'm really excited to see what they do. And Wu is very good at like darker, more introspective kind of art, if that's a good way to call it. Like
That's fair.
And I'm very curious to see why he was chosen for this. I mean, obviously he's very, very good and very good at like events too. Like he can.
Yeah, and that's something we didn't talk about.
This is the art.
Ago,
yeah.
Was that, well, the colorists, having the same colorists on Powers of 10 and House of X, it's a fantastic idea. Very well executed. But also that the creative teams for the Dawn of X books were bespoke. They were picked for those books by Jonathan Hickman.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that idea a lot.
And picking Wu for X-Men, it makes me think this is going to be a sadder story, potentially. It's going to have tons of kick-ass action, but I have a feeling it's going to be darker.
Yeah.
And anywho, so in our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, this is
Judging
where we...
Judging by the Cover Junior.
We pick... damn, I'm going to have to bottle that. This is where we pick our favorite cover that's coming out next week. And...
Judging by the Cover Junior.
That one's not as good.
Yeah, that one sucks, actually.
Sunday. Judging by the cover. My favorite cover art out next week is Absolute Carnage number 4 by Ryan Stegman. This is a fantastic cover because it captures the liquid in this cover so, so well. Basically, there is raining blood on Venom.
Yeah, and then Carnage is a nasty boy.
It's splashing and pooling and just flowing, and the energy of the droplets is quite amazing. There's so much detail in this cover. I can't imagine how long it took him to draw every droplet, but you feel that energy of the liquid blood just flowing, and it just captured my interest so much. And then Venom like screaming at the camera at us and in the image is quite something too. It just really draws you in, like it's just badass. What's your favorite cover of the week?
My favorite cover of the week is Something is Killing the Children, number 2.
But what is it?
This cover is Ian Bertram's
yes.
cover for this book. If you have seen Ian Bertram's art before, you know what this cover looks like. It depicts a woman looking down on a forest, frayed white hair, blood splattered up her face, this striking green eye, really strong contrast between black, yellow, green, red that I like a lot, and a lot of flow and motion, and I almost want to say angst in the line work. That reminds me a lot of the effect that House of Penance, a really fantastic book that Ian drew for Dark Horse, gave me. So I like it a lot. It's evocative, although not necessarily narratively driven. I like picking a lot of covers that are narratively driven, that tell a kind of in media res story, and this one very much does not do that. But on the strength of just this kind of striking pinup in and of itself, I like it. And I'm intrigued by this character's story in the same way that I'm already intrigued about the book, and I think that that's a great way to do that.
It's really creepy.
Less
cover
is more sometimes.
Yeah. This is a suits the Halloween month, I have to say.
Yeah. The tree leaf month.
In our last segment,
tree
off
leave,
topic.
L-E-A-V-E.
Do you leave right now? Because I'm talking. In our last segment, off topic, top shelf. Don't leave because we need you to assist.
Leave.
Forrest will tell you something that's non-comic related that's totally tickling his fancy. And yes, I use the word tickling in a sentence. Forrest, what is your off topic, top shelf? Just nonsense.
Last night, as of this recording, I saw Nick Cave in Seattle, and I saw Nick Cave not with the Bad Seeds. I saw Nick Cave in his Conversations with Nick Cave concert series. The conceit behind it is that Nick Cave comes out onto stage. He's got a piano and some sheet music, and he plays some Nick Cave songs. He plays some covers as well. He played a Leonard Cohen cover. He played a Jimmy Webb cover. But then he also has another microphone kind of up at the center of the stage, almost like a stand-up comedian's microphone. And what he does in between songs, and actually more of the bulk of the three-hour-plus show was this, is that in the same way that he answers fans' questions in the Red Hand Files newsletter that he started after his son unexpectedly died in 2015, there are people in the audience that walk around with these light-up red batons. People raise their hands if they have a question for Nick, and someone will walk over to them and hand them a microphone, and then Nick will point at them and say, yeah, and they ask a question of Nick. They're not filtered, they're not placed, they're not screened or anything like that. People just ask questions or tell Nick stories, and then he responds to them in this kind of experiment with fan expectation and with an incisive insight into what his fans want and are thinking about in a way that I've never, ever seen an artist do before. It was, to be hyperbolic for a moment, a life-changing experience. It enamored me to Nick Cave for probably the rest of my life. I found him insightful and wise and surprisingly funny. He covered a Daniel Johnston song on spot. Someone brought up or was wondering if he could speak about his experience with Daniel Johnston's and what is the role of the artist when we lose people like Daniel Johnston. And Nick Cave said, I can answer that by singing one of his songs if you'd like.
Nice.
And it was cool. Very obviously not prepared.
Right.
He just stood at the front of the stage and sang a Daniel Johnston song from memory. I've never, ever seen an artist do something like that. I don't think I will ever see an artist do something like that again. He talked about God and death and spirituality and the loss of his son and the love that he has for his wife and stuff in a way that didn't make me feel like I was at a TED Talk, but yeah. Did make me feel like I was really genuinely experiencing something from a very smart, very wise, but weary and sometimes difficult and estranging man. I would recommend that anyone that likes Nick Cave's music, at the very least subscribes to his newsletter. But if this show comes to your city, go to it.
Was this the start of the tour, or the
it was
end of
this
it,
was
or?
The tail end, but he indicated that he was going to do more of them in the future.
Nice.
So hopefully I share a kinship with people that have been to these shows in the past, and I'm hesitant to talk about any of the specific details of the show or the questions people's asked, because he opened with saying, please put away your phone, please don't record this, I want people to be as honest and as earnest as they can possibly be. It was really brave and exciting and different and very, very affecting, in the same way that his music has always been very affecting to me, but in a way that I felt both deepened my relationship to his music and also to the artist.
Nice.
It was amazing.
Once in a lifetime experience, unless you go again, I suppose.
Yeah. There were a couple people that were like, I've been to 17 of these now.
Oh my God.
And he would be like, thanks.
If you asked him about X-Men or House of X, what do you think he would have said?
You know, one of the songs on Skeleton Tree, his album that came out before his new album, is called Magneto.
Really?
And I almost wanted to raise my hand to be like, so tell me about comics, or tell me about Magneto. What?
Or like his relationship with comics, if he has one.
And are you caught up on Jonathan Hickman's Magnum Opus?
That's really cool. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this is the end of the show. If you've reached it this far, you probably have subscribed because you love us so much. But if you haven't, do so. Also, you can review us on Apple Podcasts. That'll help us out. And like, subscribe, tell all your friends. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thank you very much. Love you.
Bye.